Let's get going again. Two lectures back to back, both promised to be on time, so we should get done on time. So the first is by Nick Bosse, who you all know very well by now, and on this wonderful technique called random conical tilt that Ava was mentioning too, and I think you're going to mention some of her new ideas for the orthogonal.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So take it away. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sorry to inflict you another course on this last morning. I guess you had quite a lot of nice evening yesterday, so you might be tired today. I'll try to make it short. So this is just a small reminder, and you've already seen most of my slides with Joachim, but this is just about the random conical tilt and how you want to get a first reference volume when you have no information about your structure. So the basics here is that if you have a structure and if you take images of this structure in many different orientations, what you can do in the computer is to back project those 2D projections and compute a 3D average. In fact, the thing is, it's always an average, so we always suppose that we have only that we are dealing only with one structure. So here is a little bit more. I will give you here lots of slides to give you the flavor of things. I won't go into the mathematics, but this is just to get how it works. If you have a 3D structure and tilt your which is a little guy here, standing up on an EM grid, and if you tilt the grid in the microscope, you will get a tilt series like that. These are surface representation, but in the microscope you get true 2D projections, so this is more what you would get in an EM microscope. And in fact, the whole reconstruction chain relies on the central projection theorem, which states that in reciprocal space, every 2D projection of a 3D object corresponds to a central section in the 3D Fourier transform of the object, each central section being orthogonal to the direction of the projection. For instance, here, if you take projection number 4, which corresponds to this view, in the 3D Fourier transform of this guy, it would correspond to this horizontal a central section. So you see, when you have a tilt series in tomogram, you will fill up completely more or less completely the 3D Fourier transform of the object, and you just have to do a transform back in real space to get your object. The trick is that in cryo-EM we have to deal with biological objects and we have constraints. Therefore, we have to work with low dose. We tend to keep it below or around 10 electron per angstrom square. So this is a problem to get many exposures. So normally the less exposures, the better. Otherwise, you have to deal with the signal. You have also images with low signal-to-noise ratio. You have to do also lots of compromise with the defocus level and the resolution, and specifically when you work with single particles, you have to defocus quite a lot to see your particles. It depends on the size of those, of course, and then you will have to deal with the CTF. And the whole business is just computing 2D or 3D of averages, numeric averages, and so we always think that we have one conformation. So this is all one limitation of the method. Of course, if you have internal symmetries in your object, you may want to use them because they will help you to fill up this 3D Fourier transform of your object, because we will be able to use one 2D projection in many different orientations and therefore fill up the 3D transform of your object. Here, also the whole game is once you have 2D projection is to determine in which orientation they are in space, and you have to deal with a lot of conventions. So depending on which software you use, those conventions might change. These are those used in Spider, and in Spider 2D images have a horizontal X axis, a vertical Y axis, and the Z axis is towards the bottom. So it's just like the direction of the electron beam on your object. And we always deal with these Euler angles, and as you already saw them with Tim Baker, they are in fact a set of three Eulerian angles, and here I define them to you in a more different way. You have the object which is fixed in X, Y, and Z direction, and you, the observer, you're turning around just like a satellite on Google Earth, for instance. You're just taking pictures with Google Earth around your planet. Well, for psi theta phi equals to zero, you're at the North Pole. And we will see now how theta works. If you change theta from 0 to 45 or 90 degrees, you go from position 1, 2, and 3. So you go from North Pole to equator. So it's a change of latitude. If you now change the value of phi, you go from phi equals to 0 to minus 45, minus 90 degree. You go from the left here. We're on the west coast here, and we're going now towards the east coast. So you see you're changing now longitudes. Those two angles deal with the position of the satellite. The third one is just the position, the rotation of the satellite around its main axis when it takes the picture. For instance, what's the difference between position 1 and 8 or position 3 and 4? It's phi, 1, 0, 0, 4, 8, 0, 0, 90. And how does it look? One, it looks like that. 8 is turned by 90 degrees in plane of the 2D projection. So that's the last Eulerian angle. So we will just define those Eulerian angles, and we can then back project those guys. How do we deal with the fact that our objects are fragile to electron? Well, we will use, and this is the original paper that I would refer you. This method was designed by Michael Hadermacher when he was working with Joachim Frank in Albany. And this is a very nice paper. And there is another one in 88 which explains all the strategy of this reconstruction chain. But in fact, this is what's the whole chain. If you have single particles, they will tend to have preferential orientation, either in ice or on carbon film. And therefore, you can imagine that you have a set of those guys standing up on the grid, but they also have a random orientation in plane. Some are looking to the west, some are looking to the east, and some north and south. So this random in-plane rotation comes from the random conical tilt method. You will see why we call it a conical tilt method. It's because if you just have those guys standing up, and if imagine they're on a magnetic chessboard, and you just tilt the magnetic chessboard and still take a picture, now what you see is a set of images which are completely different. Here you had top views, now you have completely different things. Well, yesterday evening, while you were having some beverage and maybe some ice cube, rotating it in some kind of glass with some liquid in it, if you looked at it from just above, you were always seeing a square shape. Now, if you just went a little bit away from the above position and looked at it from the side, you will have seen all those kind of different orientations. We showed you the cubic shape. And this is a conical tilt series, because it's just like if you were looking at one single object, it's almost the same as if you, observer, were rotating and then taking pictures. And therefore, this is just how it works. With only two pictures, one tilted specimen image and a 0 degree tilt specimen image, if those guys behave well and all stand up, you get a conical tilt series. This is a way I like to look at it. I like to look at it as the object was fixed, and each time I took a picture or there is an image, you have these little dots on the sphere. This shows you the angular repartition of your projections. And in Fourier space, this is how it looks like. Each of your 2D projection is a central projection in the 3D Fourier transform of the object, and it's orthogonal to the direction of projection. Therefore, you fill up the 3D Fourier transform of your object with some kind of waffle-like type of series. And this is just a random conical tilt series. As you will see, there is one flaw into this shame, is that there is still some empty space, and this is what we call the missing cone artifact, and we will deal with that later. This is the second reference from Michael Hadermacher, and this is really the one that you need to read if you want to really dig into the mathematics of it. It's a very nice article, by the way. Now, how do we determine the three Eulerian angles corresponding to those tilted projections? Because, in fact, we will use for the 3D reconstruction only the tilted images. We don't, in fact, need the zero degree tilt image for the reconstruction itself. But if we take two images, well, it's because we need them. And you will see that we need them to determine two of the three Eulerian angles. Here I have my little guys, I just put them in random positions, and I just added some noise to mimic what happens in the microscope. And this is the same micrograph tilted by 45 degrees. By the way, here you have to take care of something in sample preparation. You need to dilute your sample, because you see that even if these guys are quite apart from each other here, when you tilt the grid in the microscope, they will be close to each other and they might overlap. Therefore, you need to dilute your sample and have quite some space. What you will do then, you digitize those micrographs and you will pick pairs of particles. You see here that it's quite... It's not really obvious to see which image corresponds to which other, but if you just blur your eyes, your vision, and just look at the constellations of the dots, you will see a little constellation here of some kind of lollipop here. You will see some kind of constellation of a lollipop squeezed here. And this is how you will be able to find homologous pairs of images in both things. And just by clicking on one image and its counterpart here, one image and its counterpart here, you will just have those relationships between the two set of images. And just by a triangulation, a calculation, you will see that if you tilt, something happens, and in fact you squeeze the disposition of the image with respect to the direction of the tilt axis. If the tilt axis is vertical here, you will squeeze your image on the side. If the tilt axis is horizontal here, you will squeeze the disposition of the tilted image in this side. Well, just by comparing the coordinates, you just then therefore find the direction in plane of the tilt axis, and this is the first Eulerian angle, which is called psi. The convention in SPIDER is that if the tilt angle here is vertical and therefore is parallel to the y-axis, then psi equals zero. This is just a convention. And the other thing is that if you measure how you squeeze the disposition of the particles orthogonally to this tilt direction, you directly can measure the cosine of the tilt axis. Cosine of theta, and theta is the second Eulerian angle, is equal to small d over big D when you measure those differences. So therefore, you see just by particle picking, you just fit the angles and find two of the three Eulerian angles. Now, what you do after picking those particles, you box them, and you, as we've seen, you float them, merge them. You can have the set of image from the zero-degree image and the tilted specimen images. And here you see that there is some material nearby because of those particles, which are now almost overlapping each other when they are too close. And you will see that those zero-degree images are still used because you will need to orient them in the similar or in-plane rotation to find the third Eulerian angle. And here, the rotation in-plane of the zero-degree tilt image is the phi angle. Here, you will see that those images are not the same, but they correspond to the same set of image here. And after 2D alignment, all those little guys now are looking in the same direction, and the rotation angle that were applied to those are the third set of Eulerian angle you need to determine the orientation of these guys, which are now masked, by the way, to take away most of the noise around, and which are just centered. So at this point, you could use directly those images to compute a 3D reconstruction from just knowing the three Eulerian angles. However, you still need those because you will need to sort them before computing the volume, because all of your particles might not correspond to the same EM view. They might correspond to top or side view or other things. Now here I just, describe you some of the algorithms for 3D reconstruction. I told you in Fourier space what you have is those 2D projections correspond to a central section in this waffle-like disposition, and you do Fourier transform back to go back in real space. Well, if you use simple back projection, you do nothing to your data, this is what you get. And this is pretty bad because, in fact, you have lost most of the details and everything is blurred. Why is it so bad? Well, because you have an uneven distribution of the signal. If I cut in half the Fourier transform here, or the schematic representation of the Fourier transform, in fact, what happens is near the center, in the blue lines that you see here, correspond to very dense zones of information, while the yellow lines here correspond to Fourier to spatial frequencies where the information is diluted. Therefore, you have some kind of imbalance between low spatial frequencies and high spatial frequencies. Now, if you want to correct for that, there is a way, and Joachim described it, and he described what we call the weighted back projection, where the same thing is done, back projection, but before we do R weighting. R star weighting, it's a very a neat term to say that in fact you just apply some kind of filtration depending on the radius. And in fact, if I go back and forth, you will see what effect it has on the 2D projections. This is the original 2D projections, and this is the weighted projection. And this is the result. Well, now you see that it's better, but there is still some big problem. The guy is anisotropic. Because why is that so? Because of the missing cone. The missing cone here corresponds to this empty zone in the Fourier transform, and it comes from the fact that you cannot tilt the grid more than to a certain degree in the microscope, because there is first not enough space, and after that, anyway, the thickness of the ice would become so great that you cannot go or see anything. Personally, also, I would advise you not to tilt more than 45 degrees, because after 45 or 50 degrees, this would be the range of tilt I would normally use. After that, it's quite hard to get good tilted images. And if you have drift or charting effect, you have to throw away a pair of images. So you might take quite a lot of time and at the microscope before getting enough pairs of images. So between 45 and 50 degrees is the range of tilt I would apply. Now, I'm sorry. This is the last type of reconstruction you will have heard of. It's a real space method, but rather than doing things in Fourier space, you do it in real space, but you correct iteratively your method. So, you start with the simple back projection, and you have a volume which is not perfect, but then you can reproject it into the same direction as your experimental images. Then these 2D projections, you can subtract them from the original images. And this subtraction 2D maps can be used to correct the original volume, and therefore you just back project them. You don't want to overcorrect the structure because you might really do it too much. So therefore, before back projecting them, you multiply them by a small attenuation factor. This is the value lambda that you hear of when you use BPRP operation in SPIDER. And this is always a very small value. Therefore, the process is quite long, but you iteratively correct your structure just by weighting those subtraction maps. And therefore, at the end, this is what you get. I would just advise some people who use BPRP to just check with the lambda value, because something bad can happen. If you use a lambda which is too big, you will start to correct, and this is the global error which is measured between the experimental image and the 2D projection sets of your volume. And this global error should go down from one cycle to the next. But if lambda is too big, you can go down very fast and then go up. If it goes up for one step, it stops. So BPRP might stop after two or three iterations and give you a very blurry volume. But in fact, it's just because you use lambda too big. If you use lambda too small, the global error will almost not go down and reach a plateau. And therefore, you will never converge to the good solution. The good lambda value should give you this type of curve, where in a few iterations, it goes from one or two orders of magnitudes down and then reach a plateau. Anyway, now there are other operations which are much faster, like BP3F or other ones that you can use in SPIDER and which might be more mathematically correct, I don't know. Therefore, this is just the original object, simple back projection, weathered back projection, and seared. You see the kind of similar structure we can get here. Now, the missing cone artifact, how do we deal with that? Well, as always in science, you have to work hard, but you also have to be lucky. And to correct for the missing cone artifact, you have to have a well-behaved particle who likes to stand up in the ice, but also likes to have other views. And you see here, you have a reconstruction from top views. You see it smeared in this direction, and this is the direction of the missing cone in Fourier space. And here you have the front view. If your guys are now lying down on the grid and not standing up, the direction of the missing cone will be 90 degree related. And rather than adding those two volumes in real space, what we do is that, and this is more accurate, is to use a 2D projection in Fourier space, orient them with respect to each other, merge those data sets, and then do a back Fourier back transform to get this volume. And this volume, by the way, now you see the missing cone has been completely filled up, and there is no empty area. Therefore, you have some kind of isotropic image that you can now use for a model-based approach. This is the artifact Joachim was mentioning, or somebody during Joachim's talk was mentioning, is what happens if you have a particle after, when you refine your structure, and you have one preferential orientation, what happens? Well, it only happens with SIRT. So if you use other 3D reconstruction method, you won't be bothered by that. But anyway, if you have only one preferred orientation, this guy here, this map looks like each dot is a new image that you add to the data set. Well, you will just smear out your structure in this direction. So you will have some kind of effect which will look like a missing cone artifact just by adding more images. So sometimes it's not good to add many images if you don't check their orientation. Normally, the more even angular repartition, the better. Now, a real case. This is a respiratory pigment from Helix pomacea, which is the burgundy snail. And in fact, this little guy has a very large respiratory pigments. There are more than 3 megadalton proteins, and it looks like hollow cylinders. This is the 45-degree image. This is the zero-degree image. You see that here, despite the fact that I diluted most of the sample, some particles tend to overlap, so you have this sample problem. And you can see homologous images from here, top view and the tilted specimen of the top view and so forth. So what you get is a set of zero-degree images. You have side views, rectangular side views, and round top views, and you have those 45-degree tilted specimen images. What I do is now I align my zero-degree images, and this tells me the last Eulerian angle. And this is the total average of those guys, by the way. And it looks quite nice, but you'd better check if this is a homogeneous set of images. And in fact, what happened here is that when we looked at those, by using multi-statistical analysis method, we could find many different types of subclasses, where you see those little dots here on the left or here on the right of the part of the volume. So you have always to classify those zero-degree images. And I thought that maybe I could show you quickly just, again, the flavor, not the real mathematics of MSA, but this might help you, because I saw in the practical that some people were having a lot of question about that. So, in fact, this is what we have in the practical. We have a set of zero-degree images of another molecule. This is just the worm hemoglobin. So it's a big thing, which is hexagonal, has hexagonal top views and rectangular side views. And also some can have also some intermediate views. And after alignment, you just create a mask. Therefore, you use the total average. It looks like that. You have top and side views, and it's some kind of in-between shape you have here. You binarize this thing. You can smooth it out and binarize it again to have a very large, smooth mask. And in fact, MSA is just first reorganizing your data. And therefore, we take one line of densities in this mask and another one and so forth, and we put all those lines next to each other in a big table. In French, we call it table de contingence. I don't know the English name for that. So now, in fact, each image is a single line in this big contingency table that you have here. And you could decide, in fact, that one image can be regarded as an object, a dot, in a multidimensional space. And here, if you had 2,754 pixels in your mask, the densities that you have in your image here, in your line, could correspond to coordinates on each of those dimensions. Here we had 76 images, so we have 76 dots in this multidimensional space. I don't go very deep into the mathematics for here. Please talk with Paul, who has a very nice presentation about what's really happening. But in fact, we're just intuitively, you just have to guess what's happening. One image or two images which look identical, they will have similar coordinates in the multidimensional space because they will have identical densities, in fact. Therefore, they will look like two dots located near each other. On the opposite, two images which are very dissimilar, they will correspond to two dots located far away from each other. So you have just by this you can check that you can interpret the results just by very intuitively. You don't have to go into the mathematics. Multidimensional statistical analysis, MSA, reinforces this idea of similarity equals proximity, but it changes the coordinate system of our data set in order to reduce the number of dimensions to a number of few meaningful axes. We don't need those 2,000 and so forth dimensions. We need to have dimensions which express variation among our images. And this is exactly what we will be doing. First, we change the origin. In fact, you see that now the sum of each line correspond to the weight of an image, and we can subtract the weight of those images, so that now the origin of this multidimensional space will be the center of gravity of our dots of images. And what we do, we change the matrix, and in fact we use a new definition of distances between those dots, which will take care of the covariance between those images. What it does, you have to remember that the mathematics is very complicated if you try to dig into it, but if you just look at what it means, it's very simple. You just, by changing this matrix, it's just like changing from a multidimensional sphere to some kind of multidimensional almond. So we will just stay in three dimensions just to see how it works, but you just split and deform your cloud of dots depending of the internal variance of your images. And in fact, there we will look for the longest distance in the almond, and this will be this first axis or eigenvector. The amplitude of this eigenvector is this lambda value, which is the eigenvalue. So you might see that in the literature. And this is the longest distance of the almond. Therefore, we can define the coordinates of each dot with respect to this new axis. Then we look for the second orthogonal major axis, which means it's the longest distance into the almond, it's the width of the almond, and it's orthogonal to the first one. It just means that it's independent variation with respect to the first one. And we have a second eigenvector, a second eigenvalue, and then we look for the third longest distance, which is orthogonal to the first and second eigenvectors, and we get, of course, the width of the almond and the thickness of the almond and so forth. And now our image can be described as dots with only 2, 3, 4, or 7 coordinates. In our practical, we have 7 coordinates. And we can reproject those dots onto 2D plans, which are, in fact, described by 1 and 2 eigenvectors. And this is what we've been doing here. And in fact, you see clearly that, again, if you just use the simple law of proximity identity, you have clearly one set of image, another set of image, a third one, and a fourth one. Therefore, you must have some kind of class averages or class of images, which are just that you can get just by visually looking at those maps. Here again, there is a very nice article from Jean-Pierre Bretaudière and Joachim Frank in 86, where they designed interesting concept to understand what is the meaning of those axes. And in fact, it's very simple. We have just compressed the information. We started with big images with 2,000 dots. We put them into lines, and then we rearrange everything and give them now coordinates. And now images can be described just by a set of coordinates. And in fact, according to you, what would be an image which would have a coordinate 0, 0, 0 on all these eigenvectors? It would be a dot which would project here. Well, it would be the total average of your images, because this is how we dealt with the weight of the images. So the barycentre, or center of gravity, is just the total average. If now you define, and you can play with that, you can reconstruct images just by giving coordinates on those eigenvectors. So just by stating 0, 0, 0, you can get back into the line of the table and into what the pixel should like into the mask, and therefore this would be the reconstitution image of 0, 0, 0. You can also play with that and reconstitute images which would have coordinates minus 0.2, this is the edge here, 0, 0 on axis 2 and 0 on axis 3, and here again, plus 0.2, 0, 0. And therefore here, just by giving new coordinates, you reconstruct images, and you clearly see that axis 1 is the sorting of top views against side views. So this becomes very clear. In literature also, you will hear about importance images, or if you use Imagit, you will hear about eigenimages. And this is just showing not what's reconstituted, but what's varying along this axis. For instance, to get this image, you just take the total average, you multiply by this importance image, and you get that. Same thing here, total average multiplied by importance image give you this reconstitution image. And you will see those in the literature. Now, this is how it looks on those axes. Reconstitution image of positive and negative part on axis 1, axis 2, axis 3, and so forth. And you can see here clearly that after those three axes, what you have is random variation or small problems of alignment. Therefore, you can decide if you want to use such or such axis for sorting your images. Here, you could use only the three first to sort your images. That would be enough, because those just correspond to noise. If you have real experimental images, 0-degree image can change by the defocus. And if you have an axis which corresponds to the change of defocus, you would have the overall change of the image, which would look as if it was blurred. And you can take this eigenvector out from your classification, because you don't need to classify with respect to the defocus. You just need to classify with respect to the orientation. And classification, you always already saw this kind of classification, ascendant classification, and where you have this kind of dendrogram from the Greek dendros, which means roots. And the higher the step, the far away you have your classes. And here it's clear that if you cut this tree here, it means that you separate image 1, 3, 4 from 2, 5, and it means quite logical, because they are far away. And this is what you get here when you classify your images. You see the top view here, which make a big class with a large jump, and it's very different from the three other classes, which are in fact two different side views plus a small class of intermediate views. This is now what we get from the helix pomacia hemocyanin, reconstitution image of axis 1, importance images, and so forth. You see, it's not that obvious to really interpret your experimental images. Now, this is a 2D projection map. You see, it's not that obvious to check and find clusters. Nevertheless, the program can find those clusters. And if I cut here, I get those five average maps. And if I cut lower, I get within this class, four subclasses, and so forth. And this is now, after merging your volumes, you get the 3D reconstruction. And you get from those 2D averages, you get the 3D volume that you computed from your tilted specimen images. I have a question for you, because most of the single particles that one can look at might have specific features, and a lot of single particles have a cylinder kind of shape. And if you have a D5 point group symmetry, you might wonder which type of view are the most useful. Are there top view? Are there side views? And as you might want to enforce the symmetry, this has some impact on the quality of your volume. And the answer is that you don't really want to use top views because the missing cone is parallel to the cylinder axis. And just by enforcing the symmetry of a D5, which means you rotate five times the volume along the cylinder axis, the missing cone will always overlap with itself, so it will never be filled up. But if you have side views and just apply the D5 point group symmetry, you will see that the missing cone will change and rotate and completely fill up with itself. Therefore, side views are very useful in cylinder reconstruction and not top views. And in fact, if you look at Helen Sabiel's reconstruction of the Gros-Yale, most of the images that they use are side views and not top views. Now, another example, and Magali showed that on her poster yesterday. Magali is working on another complex, and here we went from the assumption that we didn't know anything about the symmetry of the complex. And so we looked at it. It looks like that. We have class averages, so you have those kind of views. And we tried to compute 3D volumes from each of those classes. And then we had a big problem because we didn't enforce symmetry, and we tried to align those volumes, and you will see they look bad. And you see here a view which has some kind of triangular shape. Then this view, the cluster 5, cluster 6, are near to each other, and then cluster 10 and 11, these are the volumes I will show you now. And they look bad. They look bad because we didn't enforce any symmetry. There is small volumes, there are only very few images. And in fact, I asked Magali to make it look even worse because she didn't align those volumes. They just like that and rotated a little bit. In fact, we were on a hurry before taking the plane, so she just made that just in 5 minutes before we came. And in fact, what you want to do is you want to align images which come from classes which are quite close to each other. Here, we could align the volume of class 5 plus class 6 because they were quite close to each other, and 10 and 11. But we could never align 3 with 5 or 5 with 10. So you have to do some kind of pairwise reorientation merging. And if you merge those classes, then you can merge pairs of pairs. And we could get this, which looks a little bit like a dead chicken. And without enforcing any symmetry, we started to align all our image with respect to this reference, and we got this. And in fact, here we also injected the zero-degree image from this alignment, and we started to refine. Without imposing symmetry, we got this kind of volume. So if you get those, don't get afraid when you do a random conical tilt. You will end up with that. And if you work hard and have a fake microscope, you can go to these other type of reconstructions. Here Magali has a 9.5 map, and we are now, I just received this yesterday from France. They downloaded it from anonymous FTP, and this is now amplitude corrected with SACS. So this is just how it looks like. And now I just give you a few tips. If you have a CN symmetry, which is cylindrical, but you have a difference from the top and the bottom of your cylinder, you might end up with a problem. Because zero-degree images, you will also have two types of views here, upside down. And this is what you will get in tilted specimen images. But in fact, if you want to sort those using MSA, you will not see any difference between the projection of top and bottom views. In fact, in this project, I had to classify the tilted specimen images to kind of start to see differences of projection here with this kind of half moon here on the left or on the right. And this is the experimental averages here, and this is the 3D reconstruction volume we got from this set and 3D reconstruction from this set. So this is a little tip you might want to use if you don't have a DN symmetry but a CN symmetry. This is also a Gedanken experiment, as would say Joachim. If you have a missing cone, and this may happen if you have one of those cylinders which just want to stand up in the ice and never want to give you the side views, you will get a smeared volume. This is the map, the 3D map, which shows you exactly what happens when you have just one conical tilt series. and you have a bad missing cone with some kind of smearing here. To see if it looked like half of the helix pomacea volume that I showed you before, we just cut the helix pomacea cylinder into a half, reprojected it along those directions, and from these projections reconstructed the volumes. And the reconstructed volume from this volume with the missing cone gave that, and it looks a little bit like this one. So therefore it means that normally the structure, if it would want to behave well and have all orientation in ice, it should look like that. But because of the missing cone, it looks like that. So this is also some kind of thing, some little tip. Now there's Eva her student Andres, I have a hard time, Leschissner, are now, I guess it's accepted that it will be published very soon in GSB. They have proposed a very interesting new schematic of orthogonal tilt reconstruction, where you don't use 45 degree and 0 degree image, but you use plus and minus 45 degree images. And in fact, here you have a very short description, but if you see in your plus 45 degree image a set of image which looks like that, and if also you have another set of image from the minus 45 degree specimen image, you will see that they look alike. If you merge, align those two sets, they will give that, but the counterpart here and here, they will now create not a conical tilt, but a full tomogram, in fact. Therefore, you won't have any missing cone with this approach, so it's very interesting, actually. And I think this might be very interesting if you are dealing with, as Eva said, with different conformations, because you won't have any difference of structure. You might be able to see difference of structure just by using this approach. So the electron microscopy might be tricky, but if you do your analysis very well, you can certainly completely avoid the missing cone problem and go into a very nice isotropic 3D reconstruction volume for further refinement. So this is certainly a very nice thing, and I advise you to follow the outcome of this article, because it's a very nice description. Now, some of you might want to use stain, and there was some controversy about that. I would say use stain, of course you can, but avoid thin stain. Because what may happen is this kind of thing. If you have a two-domain structure, one touching the carbon film and one above, if you have a very small layer of stain, you might see a meniscus, which means that there is accumulation of stain in between, just nearby this clift. But in fact, as this part is not embedded in stain, it's just not visible. This is what happened here with this tetrahedron hemoglobin from a shrimp, a deep-sea shrimp, that we looked at in negative stain. And what we saw was always triangular shapes or rectangular shapes, but we, in fact, and you see this accumulation of stain, this meniscus, it comes from the fact that there is one hexagonal, one-fourth of the molecule which is above the stain layer and which provokes this accumulation of stain, but it's never visible in the experimental images. And so these are not true projections, and you cannot use those into 3D reconstruction. What you want is to use either thick stain or double layer negative staining techniques, where you tend to have double layers of carbons and some deep stain in between. Therefore, what you produce is a true projection of your structure. With that, you're safe, and you can do a 3D reconstruction, though there is always a little problem here. This is a very old project I was doing in Joachim's lab when I was a postdoc there. And you see here the negatively stained image and 3D reconstruction of a hemocyanin respiratory pigment with four monoclonal FABs. This is done in negative stain. This is done in cryo. From this type of view, you see that it looks okay, but if you look on the side view, you see those guys here, those are the FAB fragments, and you see in the eyes they have almost a 90 degree difference of orientation, but because of the sandwich technique, and because at that time I was not using, I was doing lousy microscopy too, this was not really the case, and the two FABs were flattened, and in fact we could measure a flattening effect of 30% of our structure from here. So I guess now the new techniques where you do negative staining using low dose, and you can also do cryo-negative staining techniques, you can overcome this artifact. This is just the European bank that we saw yesterday. I think it's a marvelous instrument. It will change all the our perspective on the field, and I think you should look at that. If you go a little bit down on this website, you can download some PowerPoint presentations just below those icons, and you can really look at it. This is just, we wanted to know if you can deposit FSC curve. Indeed, you can. This is just the way you use it using XML language, and this is how it will look afterwards on the bank. So please deposit your FSC curves. And otherwise, these are references. So for the random conical tilt method, please look at Michael's article in Journal of Electron Microscopic Technique from 88. It's very nice. It's clear. Check the website on SPIDER. They have tutorials available. And I guess with TAPU, we will put an updated version of the practicals that we have been giving you here. You can also contact Michael directly in the University of Vermont in Burlington. Concerning SIRT, it was implemented by Paul in SPIDER. SIRT and art reconstruction came from other fields. I don't have here the reference from the original technique and original papers, but you can. It's certainly quoted here in this paper. You have this very nice review from the perspective of how the field is going on, and now this new article on orthogonal tilt reconstruction that will appear soon in Journal of Structural Biology. And just the last one, if there is one book you need to buy on single particle, this is this one. It's the latest issue of Joachim's book, which will appear actually this month in Oxford Press University. I guess Joachim didn't want to advertise for it, but I think it's really the book where you will have every detail, the whole history, and what's evolving in the field. You had two possibilities, hard copy or just not hard copy. There is only one thing. Joachim told me there is no CD. No CD. So I guess this is wrong here. And the last thank you to all the organizers, and I thank especially everybody here which have been doing a wonderful job. Thank you, and thank you especially to Bridget, Clean, and Ron. Thank you very much.
Don't ask any questions, we might not think you understood any of the course. 9 days down the drain. Scott?
So, I wasn't clear on what advantages the CERT method would have over the weighted back projection.
The third method? The CERT. Yes. CERT, it's just two different approaches. In fact, you have the words of physicists, where everything has to go through Fourier transform and is done at once. Fourier transform is very nice. It's just you play with this very different space, and you do things in one thing. And then you have people coming from other fields, mathematicians. And I didn't show you this little sentence here. Mathematicians they have another way of dealing with things. And but anyway, some of them like to use real space. But in real space, you cannot correct in one thing in one step, but you correct iteratively. So people coming from the field of development of algorithm like this kind of thing, because you can do loop them very easily in a program. What the CERT is doing is as I said, you just subtract the experimental image from the 2D projection, and you back project them. The only thing which is different is that it smooths out a little bit your structure. So this one might be one advantage. But I would say the two methods are equivalent. I have no hard feeling from any of these methods.
Well, except that you said that you have a preferred orientation.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it seems like way of back projection, you never have to worry about that.
Yeah, in fact, it happened to me when we started to collect lots of images from, and it was not automated. Believe me, I had a hard time to go through all this just manually. But I thought at that time that adding images would solve and enhance the quality of the structure. And in fact, it didn't, because I was adding 90% of top views, which are useless for the reconstruction. So in this case, if you have a strong imbalance and one preferred orientation, then you're in trouble, because you're just over-weighting one direction of projection with respect to the others. And as Paul said, you might as well take those away, because it's not doing anything good to your structure.
Another question?
What's the difference between the correspondence analysis and the
principle? It's another way of coding the data. In correspondence analysis, you don't use the absolute values of your density, you use the frequency, the ratio, which means you divide each density by the average density of all your data set. It may mean just a small difference in what I describe it that way, but it have some constraints. In correspondence analysis, you cannot have negative value. Therefore, when you start it asks you for an additive constant that you might want to add a constant value to all your density so that it will not be negative. The other thing is that in principal component analysis, you could put in the same table qualitative a description, like not numbers but colors or other things. And in fact, principal component analysis could be a very nice tool for your data mining of Legendon, because as you've seen, you don't have to put any description. You just quote your thing, you have this huge table, and it pops out with blobs and clouds of things. And it's afterwards that you have to see if there is a trend of what it means that those clouds are far apart. And it could be a nice way to look at it. I guess statisticians now must have even more sophisticated approaches. But it's a nice way to look at your data. And there is also another thing. You can also say, what if I inject new images, but I don't want to change my table? They will be not active, but passive images. And therefore, based on the past, those images will happen to be projected in certain clusters or not. So this is also a way to inject new information, because you deal with the history and some kind of wisdom, which happened to be your data set, and it happens to be projected there, but your image don't have any impact on the definition of the eigenvectors which are already existing. So it's also some interesting things. Yeah? No. 3D variance is just like 2D variance. It's just that you deal it with that in 3D. A way Paul Penzec designed it is that you randomly pick your images and compute 3,000 or 5,000 volumes and then compare them. It needs new algorithms which are very fast, compute volumes very fast. You need a lot of space on your disk. But basically, the mathematics behind that is the same as for 2D. You're just dealing with the definition of the variance. But I would advise you to speak with Paul if you want to.
Is it available in Spider?
I would say so. I don't know. It's a procedure. I would advise to contact Paul if you want to play with this 3D variance. It's a very interesting tool if it works with your data.
No more questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.